just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready.
Okay, ready or not, more rain is coming, a lot more this weekend. Everyone's talking about how much rain we've gotten lately, and it is a lot. An estimated 18 trillion gallons of water fell in February alone. 18 trillion. That is enough to fill 27 million Olympic-sized pools. And in California, Sierra Nevada, we've received 500 inches of snow. That's about the height of a three-story building. So much snow last month was dubbed February-buried. These wet winter storms have led to severe flooding along the Russian River in Northern California. Here in Southern California, where is all this water going and what's being done to capture any of it? Andy Lipkis is the founder and president of Tree People. It's a nonprofit environmental group here in L.A. trying to make cities more sustainable in the face of global climate change. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, so we see this rain falling, rushing down the streets, and it ends up where?
Almost all of it in the ocean. For what falls on the city of Los Angeles. Overall, the county captures a lot more of that. And the good news, though, is that LA is now set to begin building the capture system because the citizens of LA City and LA County last November voted for Measure W, which will actually provide $300 million a year to start building some of the capture systems.
But, okay, what do they look like, those capture systems?
Trees, cisterns, tanks, underground tanks, and what are called infiltration systems. They look like a tank, but there's no bottom. There's gravel in areas of the city where the water can go straight to the aquifer. So I just wanted to build on your 18 trillion gallons. What fell on Los Angeles was 120 billion gallons since January, the seasonal total. And that means we actually had 60 billion gallons of capturable runoff.
And none of that was saved.
All of it
went to the ocean.
Nearly all of it went to the ocean, except some people have been installing tanks, and with a collaboration of the City of L.A., the Department of Water and Power, Bureau of Sanitation, and L.A. County Public Works and Flood Control, they actually together built a hybrid network pilot where people were given cisterns that could capture the rain.
How do you even get one of these cisterns in your house if you want one?
So that's the good news about the funding. They're not cheap right now. The LIDAR study that we did with those agencies showed that out of the 1.5 million homes in LA, 1.2 million of them have room for, on average, a 1,000-gallon tank or larger. And this sort of needs to be deployed as part of our new infrastructure. And why is because, you know, with severe and extreme climate, we need that water, one, for firefighting, two, for cooling the city down, right? Our extremes include hotter hots, wetter wets, colder colds, drier dries. So we've got worse fires. We have worse floods.
Okay.
Storms of bigger intensity, and we can't afford to throw that water away. So we need to capture it.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's why we're talking to you at the top of the show, because this is urgent.
Yeah. Because of climate, we have to build statewide, but seriously, in the city, we have to, and we can, build a distributed capture system. And that's these cisterns and tanks, big ones under schools and parks and parking lots, small ones at home. And part of the reason, and here's an example of how it worked in Malibu. One of our friends, David Hertz, who lives in the Woolsey Fire area, he had room on his land. He put in three tanks, 5,000 gallons each. He had 15,000 gallons of stored water. The fire came at his home and his community. The Ventura County Fire Department came and took his stored water and used it to save 20 or 30 homes, including his, around his neighborhood.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? And that model is what we've seen in Australia and how they've responded to the same deadly fires that we're now seeing here. They are having them 10 to 15 years ahead of us as they did their drought. And the way they've been saving homes is having people install tanks. this is a way to make sure in these new extremes that homes can be protected and it works.
Okay, well, let me ask you, Andy, if someone listening to this is like, okay, I want to get on board with this, I want to do something, what do they do?
Well, if you can afford it now, you could do what a number of people are doing. They are.
How much is it?
You could be looking at spending $5,000, $10,000 when you add the electrical pump or the gas-powered pump and the pipes and all that stuff.
Okay, so it's not cheap and everyone can do that. Are there any incentives from the government to help pay for that?
They're not enough right now. The incentives are only a few hundred dollars, but in other cities, in other countries, they're several thousand dollars, so it makes it really affordable. And when you look at the savings for the insurance companies, for the electrical grid and all of that, it makes sense to invest in these incentives. We've proven, we the people have proven, you give us incentives, we'll remove our lawns, right?
Mm-hmm.
The through line on this, that we really need to celebrate the mayor's leadership, because a couple weeks ago, he declared that LA was going, he set the goal for 100% recycling of wastewater from our sewage treatment plants. That may seem weird and obscure, but it's absolutely essential, because that water also needs to be added to our supply. And if you do a full rainwater capture system, plus that wastewater, plus if everyone just stays using, conserving water the way we do today, and we clean up the San Fernando Valley aquifer, that means we have 100% of the water we need without importing any from up north.
And it means no more reliance on the Colorado River either?
Exactly.
Huh. So we would be 100% self-sustaining when it came to water.
It's right within reach. And when the mayor made that declaration, he's accelerated the timeline. When UCLA studied it, they said it might take till 2050. He set a goal of 2035. We really, because of the severe and fast change in of extreme climate, we have to implement this rainwater capture system much sooner than people thought.
Okay, so 16 years, that's within most of our lifetimes.
Yes.
We will be 100% reliant, self-sustaining when it comes to water.
We need people to say, we want to do this. This is a different paradigm, right? We're all in it together, but we can do it. A lot of people think, well, that'd be weird to have a tank, but no, it's not. It feels very secure to have that backup for you. More trees to shade our homes and cool our city and save our lives during the extreme heat that we have coming and getting worse. So it's a good news story.
Andy, thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Lipkis, founder and president of Tree People. That's a nonprofit environmental group. Well, before we had all this rain, California experienced the deadliest wildfire season on record. And yesterday, PG&E said its faulty equipment probably caused the fire in Paradise that destroyed that town and killed 85 people. There are already more than 40 lawsuits against PG&E for that fire, and that is part of a much larger problem for PG&E. It faces hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits for previous fires. The company has filed for bankruptcy. And it seems, though, that we in California, well, we're stuck with PG&E. Things are going to get worse with climate change, of course. Mark Chediak recently wrote about this. He's energy reporter for Bloomberg News. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, great to have you on the show. So is that expected that PG&E would say, yeah, it was our equipment that did this?
No, it was actually a little bit of a surprise. The utility had been saying that it did not know, or there hadn't been a conclusion to what had caused the campfire. So that took some investors and some PG&E watchers by surprise. Typically, companies will wait for CAL FIRE, the agency that investigates the cause of these big wildfires. They will wait for them to issue a ruling. CAL FIRE has yet to determine exactly what has caused the fire, but PG&E felt as if they had collected enough evidence on their own to say that they probably started it.
Right. So why would they do that? Why wouldn't they wait till CAL FIRE determined it?
Well, a couple of things. One, the company disclosed in January, basically, when they filed for bankruptcy, that they were facing up to $30 billion in potential claims related to wildfires in 2018 and 2017. And investors and watchers of the company were kind of waiting for the company to sort of detail exactly how that amount broke down. And I think the company basically wanted to signal to the bankruptcy court and to investors that, hey, it looks like we're probably going to be found responsible for this fire. And you know, the key thing yesterday is that they disclosed they think it'll cost them at least $10.5 billion.
Wow. $10.5 billion?
That's correct. That is more than the market capitalization of the company.
Okay. So yet, with all these problems, PG&E still functions, and we're kind of stuck with them, right? So what can be done to make this company better and more reliable and less prone to causing wildfires?
That's a great question. It's a question that Governor Gavin Newsom and state legislators and state regulators and investors and customers are all grappling with right now. There are a number of ideas being thrown out there. PG&E itself has said that they are going to step up inspections and repairs on their lines. They have even said that they will shut power if they feel like the wildfire risk is too high, and they're going to start doing that this summer. Actually, the utilities in your area, Southern California Edison and San Diego Gas and Electric, have also said that they would do the same thing to avoid fire risk.
Are those companies better managed than PG&E when it comes to this issue?
San Diego Gas and Electric has been kind of held up as the good utility in all of this. They had some very bad fires in 2007. That ended up costing them quite a bit of money. And they put in place a number of things, such as installing weather stations, fire monitoring systems, cameras, and they also started turning off power if fire risk became too high. So they're kind of looked at as the model utility here. And then Southern California Edison and PG&E are kind of trying to adopt some of those measures.
So they could learn something from San Diego.
Yes, that's right. And they are trying to do some of the things that San Diego Gas and Electric has been doing. But some people would say, you know, these other utilities have just been lucky that they just haven't had a really big fire. Well, actually, Southern California Edison has had a couple big fires the last 2 years. They just haven't been as deadly or as destructive as the fires in Northern California. But with climate change, and our summers, sort of our dry season getting longer, and our winter is kind of sometimes becoming wetter, there's a concern that things are just going to get worse across the state.
Hmm. Okay. And so what are some of the outside-the-box ideas for trying to make things better to handle that?
Well, they go from having the utility company underground its power line. Mm-hmm. That can be very expensive.
So can settlements and wildfires.
Exactly. Well, that's what the proponents of undergrounding say. It can be cheaper than, you know, sparking these multi-billion-dollar fires. People are looking at maybe installing more distributed energy like solar and batteries and having a more localized grid so you don't have these big power lines running through these dry forested areas. The state has been looking at potentially or considering taking over parts of all of the utility or splitting the utility up, splitting off parts of its business so the company can just focus on keeping its wires safe.
And where is Governor Newsom on all these ideas?
Oh, that's a good question. He has come out and said that he thinks it's important for the state to have healthy, viable utilities, and he is looking at ways in order to do that. He has put together what he has called a strike team to develop a plan for PG&E's bankruptcy, and they will reveal that within 60 days. But he has noted that the company has had some problems in the past, and they haven't been a trusted player, and that they are looking for changes at the company, including with the management. But at the same time, the governor has acknowledged that this issue is not just a PG&E issue, but a statewide issue with the issue of climate change and how the state is going to manage these new risks.
Well, Mark, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Mark Chediak, energy reporter for Bloomberg News. Coming up, the comments section on YouTube videos can attract some real creeps, especially if the videos are made by young girls. YouTube finally does something about it. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Kids are obsessed with YouTube, and many love to post videos of themselves. You can see young girls dancing, doing cartwheels, putting on makeup, opening presents. Well, anyone can see them. And yeah, that means what you're thinking. People who you wouldn't want anywhere near young girls are watching these videos. This week, YouTube suspended comments on videos because predators were leaving sexually suggestive comments. Here to talk about this and what YouTube is doing to protect its young users is Javi Lieber. She covers tech and business for Vox. Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you. Okay, so tell us about this, because these videos, obviously, they're just innocuous videos. What's happening? How did they get on the radar of these pedophiles?
A lot of people, as it's been discovered, are coming onto YouTube looking for this type of seemingly innocent behavior. And what has been discovered over the last week or so is that in the comments section of YouTube, there is what people are referring to as a softcore pedophile ring. And basically what's happening is people are coming onto YouTube looking at these innocent videos of children, mostly girls, some as young as five, playing all sorts of games and doing all sorts of sports. And in these videos, some of their private parts are being exposed. And in the comments, people are leaving sexually suggestive comments. And then they're also leaving timestamps. So I've looked at a lot of these comments, and you can see somebody will write, you know, 27 minutes. And then if you scroll to 27, that is the timestamp of when you can actually see this type of stuff. And yeah, it's really, really gross. And before YouTube disabled the comments on minors, what was happening also is that a lot of these YouTube anonymous users were exchanging information as well. So they were basically spreading communication to be communicating IRL. So sharing information, WhatsApp numbers, and according to one YouTube vlogger who had, you know, kind of like discovered this network, he said that they were actually then trading child pornography. The worst part is that in some of these cases, the children who are on YouTube and are, you know, on it for innocent reasons are actually even communicating with some of these commenters.
Oh my gosh.
The problem is it's bad.
Yeah, really bad. And so YouTube, though, as you say, this has been, these videos have been online for years, and only now YouTube is doing something about it?
I think, you know, from talking to creators, people know that there's, you know, trolls in comments. Everybody says don't read the comments. And YouTube has a huge community of commenters, and people know that this stuff has existed. But what's really gotten YouTube to act over the last week or two is that giant advertisers are now pulling their money from their advertising programs, which is essentially how Google makes its billions. So you have companies like AT&T, Disney, Hasbro, Epic Games, which owns Fortnite, and Nestle. They're all pulling their ads from YouTube, and they're saying that, you know, they don't want to work with the tech giant until it can solve this issue. And it's twofold, right? They don't want to be associated with this type of content because it's obviously bad for business and deeply disturbing. But their programming is essentially what's monetizing this content. So it's really just deeply immoral and frankly just offensive.
Yeah. And so this all came to light because this guy posted a video where he discovered it, right? And then it went viral. It got millions of views. This video of him saying, oh my gosh, there's this wormhole of softcore pedophilia on YouTube.
Sure, sure. The YouTube vlogger's name is Matt Watson. He's a pretty big YouTube star. And he had posted a 20-minute investigation basically showing you how the YouTube algorithm works. So when you're scrolling through the video sharing website, you're searching for something, and then the YouTube algorithm is essentially feeding you what you want to see. So if you're searching for something as seemingly innocent as girls playing Twister, all of a sudden search terms will pop up, girls playing Twisters and skirts, because they're showing you what other people with similar interests are looking for. So not only is YouTube hosting this ring of alleged softcore pedophiles, they're feeding them the content information as well.
So is the only way to handle this is just remove the comments, like not allow comments at all on these videos?
I think deleting the comments is definitely part of the solution. I think also YouTube needs to be stronger and act quicker about abuse on its platform. You know, this is the second to most visited website on the internet, following just behind Google, which is its parent company. So these two platforms essentially own the internet. So it's pretty mind-blowing to me that they can't figure out how to get on top of this type of content. I think that in addition to the comments being closed, you need to be kicking off users who are uploading videos. You know, mm-hmm. when I was doing my research, sure, there were videos of gymnastics competitions and little girls doing yoga. But then, like I had mentioned before, the videos about girls playing Twister, when you start going through the videos, there's a lot of just really, really disturbing videos of preteen girls playing Twister in their underwear. And it's pretty clear why this type of content is being uploaded onto the internet. And, you know, this is the type of stuff that if YouTube really wants to be serious about child safety and teenage safety on the internet, this is the type of stuff they're going to have to get rid of.
Yeah. I wonder also, because a lot of these things are challenges, right? There's the Twister challenge, there's the popsicle challenge, the yoga challenge. Is it possible that these pedophiles are creating these challenges in the first place?
It's entirely possible. I mean, the thing about the internet is that it is just, it's the wild, wild west, you know? There's all sorts of really, really dangerous stuff that happens on social media, especially with children. And if they're not built with safety in mind, like YouTube wasn't, like TikTok wasn't, like Facebook wasn't, you know, when privacy is not your main and utmost concern, then really, really scary things can happen.
Right. And they have the ability, the technology to actually do something about it, to try to prevent that from happening, and they could do it, and they just
sure. I mean, I'm not a software engineer. I imagine building sophisticated algorithms is hard, but I mean, if there's any company that can do it, it's Google. Mm-hmm. They have billions of dollars to spend. They have a huge team. They have people all across the web, and you know, to have human moderators be looking for this type of content is just not a viable solution. So you know, already as this storm has been blowing up over the last week, YouTube has already put out a statement that they're shutting down the comments on all videos of minors, even ones that's seemingly innocent, which of course is making YouTube creators really upset. But then they also said that they're going to be beefing up their algorithms so that they can catch abuse much faster. And this is a good thing, but really, I just want to know what took them so long.
Chavie Lieber, she reports on tech and business for Vox. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on the program, how everyday violence affects school kids in South LA. And later, we will have your Friday film reviews.
There's a part in the movie, like before things go really off the rails, where you're like, if Isabella Huppert wants to be your friend, you say yes. Like,
yes.
Creepiness aside, you say yes.
That's coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Every time there is a school shooting, it seems the national media usually spends days covering the aftermath. Politicians urge action. There's an outpouring of grief for the families who lost their kids. But some LA County students, will they face the same trauma and stress from shootings? And pretty much on a regular basis, there is scant attention paid. There have been scores of homicides clustered within a mile of some South LA high schools in recent years. So imagine how that affects kids as they try to get to school and then as they try to learn in the classroom. Reporter Sonali Kohli spent months looking into the violence that surrounds some LA schools. She covers education for the LA Times and she joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
Well, I want to start with a conversation that you had with a 17-year-old and what she had to process. First, tell us about her and how she incorporates this violence in her daily life.
I think you're talking about Jalea, who uh-huh. attends Hawkins High School and is a senior there. She, between her sophomore and junior year, lost four good friends to shootings. And she kind of accepts this constant death as a normal part of her life. She says that in the days that after one of her close friends dies, you know, she can't concentrate for the day after. She's sad for a few days. She goes to the funerals. But she's a very like bubbly, energetic, positive, happy person. And she says that she bounces back to that pretty quickly because she just kind of has to.
Does she have any moments where she's not bubbly and where this is really affecting her?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely an undercurrent of anger about the situation that if you talk to her for more than 10 minutes, you see, like, she's really mad that this is happening all the time. The fact is that homicides have decreased in LA County, mm-hmm. but if you're 17 years old, you don't see that. You weren't here in the 90s when that was happening.
And if you're in a particular neighborhood where they're concentrated, you don't see it.
Yeah.
And so you decided to go out and actually interview kids and how they deal with it day to day. And I guess one of the things is just getting to school is fraught for many kids. And so there's a boy that you interview named Carl who talks about that.
Yeah, Carl is a 10th grader at Dimerly High School. That's the school that, in the time period we analyzed, was surrounded by the highest number of homicides from 2014 to 2018. There were 105 people killed within a mile of the campus. Just in the end of the school year in 2018, in May, two children who were 15 were killed less than a mile away. One of them, Monier, had been a student at Dimerly. And then about a month later, as the school was getting ready for graduation, a school campus aide was killed walking to school to get to school. So for Carl, who attends the school, he has to think about like the gang members who he knows are on his street and kind of how to avoid them so that they won't approach him or you know, disrupt him on his way to school. His older brother was killed in a hit and run very close by, so he worries about that. He has been chased by some dogs, so he's scared of those. Like, he flinches when he passes dogs that are barking. And he's, like, figured out his route to school. He goes down the street with the least dogs, so that because he's been chased a few times. And then he sometimes passes, like, memorials to people who have been killed. So whether or not he knew them, you see, like, okay, someone was killed here. And that's a reminder that it's a possibility. So he's thinking about all those things, and the way that he deals with it is, he's after we finished reporting or after we walked to school with him, he started biking, which makes him feel a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And he used to try to get to school early so he could like go inside campus, decompress, watch some funny videos on his phone and kind of get ready to actually learn.
What is the source of this violence? Is it gang warfare? Is it what's happening?
So, it depends who you ask. When I asked police, they didn't have a data breakdown of why each homicide happens. But if you ask police, they'll say anecdotally that around the schools that are most impacted, homicides are mostly due to gang violence. If you talk to mental health workers who work with students, they talk about the root reasons for that gang violence. And also, they talk about the kind of recruiting process that starts when students are children, right? Like when they're students and the generations of poverty that have existed in some of these communities that mean that parents are working really long hours and students might be looking for validation, for support, for safety, sometimes for protection, for money. There's a lot of different reasons.
So these kids, like Carl, they're afraid that they'll be hit by a random bullet or that they'll be targeted?
Both. Carl and his mom have kind of grown used to hearing gunfire near the apartment. And he was walking to school and like found a bullet casing. And it kind of adds up. It's like all of the other things we talked about. I think a lot of kids don't walk to school thinking, who's going to shoot me today? Because constantly thinking about it, right, would be super overwhelming. And so it just becomes like this normal part of everyday reality that, okay, I have to think about my safety. I have to think about where I'm going. I have to be careful. I have to not walk in alleys or side streets. And so it becomes kind of like a subconscious thing that's worrying you.
And when they get to school, is there any help for them? Like, let's say one of their classmates has been killed or they've seen a dead body or whatever, and they just feel traumatized or all of this has just been just too much and weighing on them. Is there any outlet for them, any help for them once they arrive.
Yeah, so a lot of the campuses that are surrounded by the most homicide are in the Los Angeles Unified School District. And LAUSD's mental health department is pretty good at responding to crises. So when Monier and Lamarion were the two 15-year-olds who were killed on Mother's Day last year, when that happened, multiple schools had crisis teams on campus, and they had like rooms set up for the students to go and talk about these issues. One of the things, though, is that you need long-term support. It's not enough to just have a crisis team. It helps, but it's not enough to just have a crisis team there. And principals are frustrated because it's really hard to have mental health workers on campus to address all of the needs of students. And one of the things is preparing them before something happens. So there's these things called community circles where teachers will have a circle like once a week with all their students, and they'll talk about their feelings about like silly things and serious things. And then that teaches them to identify feelings and talk about them and listen to other people talking about them, so that when something really bad happens, like their friend dies, they know that like this is a thing that can help them to cope and feel better, and they're already practiced in it. So preventative measures are also a thing that is important.
So I wonder if social media is also another problem here, because then you've got posts on Instagram of some of this, and whether or not that's sort of exacerbating the trauma these kids are experiencing.
Yeah, students I talked to said that Instagram is often how they find out that someone has died. You know, they will be scrolling through their feed is just Instagram or Snapchat. Their feeds are just filled with posts about the person who's passed away. And that's obviously, I mean, there's no good way to find out that someone you're close to has died or someone you know has died. But it is a constant reminder as well. Yeah.
You profile one teacher who actually talks about how kids can't really come into the classroom and just be ready to learn and excited to learn with all of this going on. How does he teach?
Yeah, that was Jason Powell. He's a teacher at Dimeley. He teaches English and music. What he said was, you know, when kids are coming in and someone really close to them has died, they might be welled with emotion. They can't concentrate. So sometimes he will try to refer them to a mental health worker on campus. And if something's happened where he knows the class is going to be affected, he'll stop the class. He knows they're not going to learn whatever he's trying to teach that day on the whiteboard. So he'll have those community circles. He'll ask, and the questions will be like, how do you deal with loss? How do you deal with pain? And he'll talk about that. And he'll sometimes have one-on-one conversations with students too. But, you know, the losses are really hard for teachers too. Like when the campus aide died, that was really hard for both the staff and the students. And it was hard for him, for Jason.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, what you're describing really sounds like a war zone. I mean, it sounds like what you hear happening in other countries.
It does. More than one student that I talked to said that they want to join the military. Carl said that he wants to join the military because he feels like it'll give him survival skills to survive in his community.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. So that's one of the things he said to me. Jalea, she, when I first started talking to her, talked about wanting to join the Marines. She thought it would be a way out of the community. Because she feels like her friends would want her to remember them, but also like get out and be successful and be safe. And she felt like the Marines was a way to do that. She's since, I think, changed her mind, and she wants to graduate and go to community college and maybe is interested in journalism, which is exciting. But there are students who want to join the military because they feel like it'll give them survival skills to live in the communities that they live in now.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. Thank you for your reporting. And I urge everyone to go check it out at the LA Times website. Sonali Kohli covers education for the Times.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we will have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so you know what that means. It's time for movie reviews. Jacqueline Coley is here, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. Welcome back.
Glad to be back.
And William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed. Welcome back to you.
Honored to be here.
Honored to have you. Okay, let's start with the big release this weekend. It's called Greta, starring Chloe Grace Moretz and Isabelle Huppert.
I guess she's been planting bags around the city. I was hoping someone brings them back to her. And you did. Oh my God, it's her. Just let it ring. I saw the bags, Greta. And I never want to see you again.
Okay. Some
That's
bags.
A weird clip to listen to. That doesn't tell you
I
anything.
I saw the bags. What so are weird. The bags?
Okay, so Greta is a film that stars the great Isabelle Huppert as a woman in New York who she leaves a bag, like a handbag, on the New York subway. Chloe Grace Moretz plays a naive young woman who finds it and decides to return it. They develop a relationship, friendship. She becomes Chloe Grace Moretz's surrogate mother, and then Chloe Grace Moretz discovers that, I guess they spoiled it in the trailer, Isabelle Huppert has been leaving those things around town trying to collect young women to be her surrogate kids,
wow.
And it becomes a creepy stalker movie. And it's a really very fun one. I had a really good time watching this somewhat campy, but very knowing and very playful callback thriller to, you know, stuff like Straitjacket and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. It's great.
Directed by Neil Jordan of Crying Game fame.
Yeah, and then I honestly love that he always gets Stephen in all of his films.
Like Stephen Ray?
Yeah, Stephen Ray. He just wedges him in there no matter what he can do. And in his role in this one, you can tell it's a wedge, but I was still happy to see him because I'm like, yay, Neil Jordan. This is great. I love it. And I will admit, though, if it's not Isabelle Huppert, this film kind of falls apart. Like, Chloe Grace Moretz just kind of lays there with the role. She's the straight, you know, girl that's stalked, you know, a kind of aimless post-grad, and, you know, she gets this surrogate mom who's not the mom you want. I loved the single white female meets mommy dearest aspect of it. I did just love how it was just like the stalkery sort of, you know, roommate type callback movie.
It's really quite great, and Isabelle Huppert is just swinging for the fences in that she's dancing around her apartment and she's doing horrible, evil things.
I mean, if you want to be kidnapped by anyone, it would be her, for
Honestly,
sure.
Honestly, I was like, why? There's a part in the movie, like, before things go really off the rails, where you're like, if Isabelle Huppert wants to be your friend, you say yes. Like,
yes!
You know, creepiness aside, you say yes. And of course, you know, she's just great. And I loved seeing her in another English-speaking role. And yeah, it was great.
Okay. Moving on to a documentary, Apollo 11. It's about NASA's moon landing mission that landed two men on the moon in 1969.
The whole Apollo program was designed to get two Americans to the lunar surface and back again to Earth safely. The enormity of this event is something that only history will be able to judge.
Okay, Jacqueline, I think we know the ending to this story. We've seen it many, many times. Do we need to see another version of this?
This is what's so crazy about this. Todd Douglas Miller, the director of this, did this non-narrative documentary of the Apollo mission, and it is really like from launch to landing. It gets nothing lost in this. It's very judicious, and it's really entertaining. Mm-hmm. And again, we know the ending. We just had Hidden Figures. Last year, we just had First Man. You would think that this would be such a retread. Why would we go back? But the new footage that they sort of infused into the narrative, where you really feel almost voyeuristically in this moment. You go back to the 1960s in this time where the audacity of this excellence was something that every American was like, you know, built
it,
in
it
to
really
achieve.
Knit the nation together.
Exactly.
At a very fraught time.
Very much so. And they definitely call back to all that. They use news footage of the time, you know, talking about the Chappaquiddick incident, which was like a news story that kind of got buried by the whole moon landing. But it was great. And really, I think if people went to First Man and felt that there was parts of that narrative that were missing, you're going to be very pleasantly surprised, I think, with Apollo 11. It's playing in IMAX, which I honestly think is the way you should see it. It is very cinematic. And again, no interviews, no narrative, no voiceover. It's just the footage. It is so compelling.
And they have new footage that hasn't been seen,
yes,
right?
Yes, new footage that hasn't been seen. And one of the great moments is when the new footage kind of meets up to the footage that you're very familiar with, like Neil's first steps and certain quotes from the Houston control room, you feel back into it. And it like it grounds you back into like, oh, this is where that occurred in that timeline. Because it's almost like beat for beat, moment for moment. It kind of has a running clock through of like, this is where we are day four, day five, day six.
And that sounds so exciting.
Yeah, great journey.
Okay, great. So that's Apollo 11. Next up, Transit, a French thriller all the dialogue in French, so we're not going to play a clip.
Oh.
So we're just going straight to you.
Sorry, French speakers.
I know, I'm personally a little disappointed, but whatever. Okay, so William, okay. You saw this one.
Yeah, and this is a really excellent drama from writer-director Christian Petzold, and he's adapting a book by Anna Sagers, who wrote in the 1940s, she fled fascistic Europe and occupied France, and she spent time in Marseille, which is a port city, with people who had stories to tell. This is a story about a man going through that. It's a story of mistaken identity. It plays a lot like Casablanca without all that pesky hope. But what's really fascinating about it as a motion picture, it's beautifully acted. It's really just sort of impeccably realized. But what's really fascinating about it was Christian Petzold took this World War II novel and said, hey, we're just going to set it in the present day and never talk about it. And what's it's really, without using the word Nazi, but just the rise of fascism, the culling of the immigrant populace, and you realize that... Oh, dang it, this plays way too accurate. Like, this is way too, in like two political steps, we could be here. Mm-hmm. And it takes something that is just on its own, on a flat merit, just an excellent drama about people in desperate situations trying to, you know, flee for their life, trying to do the right thing when fate has other plans for everybody. But also, you have to think to yourself, oh, after all of these decades of making World War II movies, warning people about how easy it was to do this again, why are we so close? Like, well, how did we,
yeah, because
why did no one pay attention?
It's so easy to look at those movies and say, oh, that was so long ago, and yeah. We would never do that today.
We turn Nazis into zombies we kill in mm-hmm. video games, and in actuality, the actual political implications got kind of lost. And Transit is a film that is very mature. I don't think it's really going to connect with young audiences, which is a shame, because I think that's who really needs to see a movie.
But why
like
wouldn't
this.
It connect with?
Because there's nothing pulp about it. There's nothing mm-hmm. fun. A lot of people go to movies for escapism. This is not escapism. This is a film about the actual desperation comes from needing to escape. Mm-hmm. And that is maybe not marketable, but I hope people see it because it is excellently crafted, genuinely thought-provoking, a wonderful film.
Okay. Great. That's called Transit. Finally, speaking of escape, Climax, directed by Gaspar Noé and starring Sofia Boutella.
Oh, you're so good.
You liked it?
I'm so happy. I couldn't be happier.
All right. Jacqueline, what's happening there?
Okay, so this is sort of a one wild night in a French dance hall, this sort of ragtag amateur group of French dancers who are all brilliant, I might add, are at a fete. It's the end of their 3 days of rehearsal, and they are having a party, and somebody spikes the punch bowl of LSD, and the like hijinks that you would expect to ensue for a Gaspar Noé film. This is a guy that bought us Enter the Void and also Love. He is kind of known for provoking and disgusting and sort of putting his audience on edge. And he does all of the things in this film that you would expect from a Gaspar Noé film. I do say this, the opening shot of this film is 10 minutes of the most intricate, beautiful dance number that you have ever seen. I seriously wish that the film after that moment could live up to anything that I could say was worthwhile, but it could not.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a troubling movie, and not, I think, in the way that Gaspar Noé intended. This film plays a lot like, you know, the sort of Roger Corman scare films about drugs in the 1960s. Take LSD and everyone's going to die, man. And yeah, and there's murder, there's chaos, there's tragedy, there's sex, but yeah, it's all incredibly simplistic, and it's really just petty, simplistic ugliness. And also,
it's kind of really offensive, I might add.
Really?
Too.
Kind of racist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, oh, it's racist?
I will put it to you this way. I will say it's problematic at best. I will leave William to lean into it more to where it goes in its worst moment. For an entirely almost POC cast, I would say like 85%, there is still a line of demarcation, which is that all of the dark-skinned actors and actresses, yes, they're all hypersexualized and violent and drugged up and awful, but we absolutely have to make the dark-skinned actors and actresses the worst. There is one sequence where these two black French youths literally spend 30 minutes and their only dialogue is about aggressively pursuing sexual encounters with the women there that night, where consent, it is implied, is not necessarily necessary, and talking about their genitals. And that is all the character development that these two gentlemen are given.
And once the drugs kick in, yeah, a lot of that is acted on. And
yes.
There might not necessarily be racist diatribes in the movie, like directly from a political perspective, but if you're a racist and you see a movie like this, you're going to say to yourself, well, that validates everything.
Yeah,
think.
I mean, it really
It
was hard for me to watch. In fact, it was my second time attempting to watch the film. The first time I'd walked out, and I remember this one. I was like, okay, I got a review, so I'm going to watch it all the way through. And I remember the moment when I was just like, this is it. And again, just objectification. And what's silly is, if had Gaspar Noé just done a little bit of shifting with which character does what, this could have been completely avoided, what I found to be offensive. But again, this is the guy's intention. So for a guy that says to everyone that he was shocked that this film was not found to be so reprehensible that he actually got good reviews, I think, and it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, again, I think that's more of an indictment to the current representation in film criticism, that not enough people of color, I think, got to review and comment on the film, because I think all of them, including myself, would find it to be, you know, again, reprehensible. But again, I know saying these words that if it's Gaspar Noé and he's listening to this, he's like, yes, because this is his intention. So I wonder
Again, what's the intention here? Is the intention to make us feel bad with your movie? Okay, well done, I guess. Yes. But
I'm
in service of what?
I'm guessing that's not the intention.
I give Gaspar Noé credit for this. He never falls into the trap of showing us the hallucinations. We're just watching people flip out objectively from the outside. And she's really good.
The entire movie is an LSD trip.
Yes, but we are not taking
internalized.
It.
We're the straight man.
When we walk into the movie theater, they should just hand us a little piece of paper.
I don't know if that's recommended. Yeah.
I think that would be an ugly scene.
You're the sober person at a party where everybody is severely drugged out.
And it's as fun as that sounds.
That sounds like not fun. So, but good that we have other movies to go to this weekend. All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed. Jacqueline Coley, editor for Rotten Tomatoes. And fresh off his acid trip, no, Christian Bordahl is here.
No. Hello. Water everywhere and nary a drop to drink. We've been talking about water. You talk about water at the top of the show, and there's more rain coming this weekend. There's another storm coming next week sometime.
It just does not stop.
So I asked if people are still loving it. You did on the show. David Reinwald said, "Love it when I'm falling asleep, but this isn't why I live here in California, in Southern California. But I am happy that there won't be a drought this year." Jessica Levinson, our own legal.
Yes. What did she say?
She says, "I melt in the rain. I thought you knew that by now." Harrison tweets, "Yes, he's still loving it, as does our KCLW DJ Matthew Schreier. He's still into it." Isabel Higgins says, "I'm still loving it because once it ends, it's months of a scorch fest."
That's true.
And
a mosquito scorch fest when we have all this water, too.
That's true. Yes, there will be mosquitoes and all of the disease that comes with them. But, you know, loving numbers, I had to look this up in the LA Almanac. And we, in January, got almost 6 inches of rain. In February, 5.5. Put that in context. The 7 wettest seasons on all record. The rain season starts in July for some reason. Uh-huh. So for now, we've got almost 16 inches of rain over the course of this season from July to now.
Okay.
So put that in context. The 7 wettest seasons on record have all been more than 30 inches of rain, like more than double what we've had so far.
Really?
Yeah.
I find that difficult to believe.
In fact, we had one only a few years ago, 2004, 2005. I think it was like a huge wet season. With more than 30 inches of
wetter
rain.
Wetter than now.
But then again, the 4 of the 7 driest seasons have all come since the year 2000. So we are definitely in this patch of time where we tend not to get this kind of rain and we're not really used to it.
Okay, so we should be grateful is what you're saying.
We should.
All right. Grateful for you, listeners. That's it for Press Play. Our show is directed by Sarah Sweeney. Our producers are Christian Bordahl, Amy Tom, Michelle Aloy, Yael, Evan Orr, Alex Trigvadotter, Caitlin Plummer, Adriana Cargill, and Rosalie Atkinson. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. Phil Richards and Joel Stein engineered. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend. I'll see you on Monday.